News of the argument between John and Phyllis spread through the crew. Maya was unsure who was telling the story. Neither John nor Phyllis seemed inclined to speak of it. Then she saw Frank with Hiroko, laughing as he told her something. Walking by them, she heard Hiroko say, "You've got to admit Phyllis is right about that part. We don't understand the why of things at all." Frank, then, sowing discord between Phyllis and John, and, not a trivial point, Christianity was still a major force in America and elsewhere. If word got around back home that John Boone was anti-Christian, it could give him problems, and that wouldn't be such a bad thing for Frank. They were all getting media play on Earth, but if you watched some of the news and features, it became clear that some were getting more than others, and this made them seem more powerful, and so they became more powerful in fact, by association. Among this group were Vlad and Ursula, who she suspected were more than friends now, Frank, Sax, all people who had been well known before their selection, and none so much as John. So that any diminution in Earth's regard for one of them might have a kind of corresponding effect on their status within the Ares. This, at any rate, seemed to be Frank's operating principle. It felt as if they were confined to the interior of a hotel with no exits, without even any balconies. The oppression of hotel life was growing. They had been inside now for 4 long months, but it was still less than half their trip, and none of their carefully designed physical surroundings or daily routines could hasten its end. Then one morning, the second flight team was dealing with another of Arcadi's problem runs when all at once red lights burned on several screens. "A solar flare has been detected by the solar monitoring equipment," Raya said. Arcadi stood quickly. "That's not me," he exclaimed, and leaned over to read the screen nearest him. He looked up, met his colleague's skeptical stares, grinned. "Sorry, friends, this is the real Wolf." An emergency message from Houston confirmed him. He could have faked those as well, but he was headed for the nearest spoke, and there was nothing they could do. Fake or not, they had to follow. In fact, a big solar flare was an event they had simulated many times before. Everyone had tasks to perform, quite a few of them, in a very short time, so they ran around the Tauruses, cursing their luck and trying not to get in each other's way. There was a lot to do, as battening down was complicated and not very automated. In the midst of dragging plant trays into the plant shelter, Janet yelled, "Is this one of Arcadi's tests?" "He says not. Shit!" They had left Earth during the low point in the 11-year sunspot cycle specifically to reduce the chance of a flare like this occurring, and here it was anyway. They had about half an hour before the first radiation arrived, and no more than an hour after that, the really hard stuff would follow. Emergencies in space can be as obvious as an explosion or as intangible as an equation, but their obviousness has nothing to do with how dangerous they are. The crew's senses would never perceive the subatomic wind approaching them, and yet it was one of the worst things that could have happened, and everyone knew it. They ran through the Tauruses to get their bit of battening done. Plants had to be covered or moved to protected areas. The chickens and pigs and pygmy cows and the rest of the animals and birds had to be herded into their own little shelters. Seeds and frozen embryos had to be collected and carried along. Sensitive electrical components had to be boxed or likewise carried along. When they were done with these high-speed tasks, they yanked themselves up the spokes to the central shaft as fast as they could, and then flew down the central shaft tube to the storm shelter, which was directly behind the tube's aft end. Hiroko and her biosphere team were the last ones in, banging through the hatch a full 27 minutes after the initial alarm. They hurtled into the weightless space, flushed and out of breath. "Has it started yet?" "Not yet." They plucked personal dosimeters from a Velcro rack of them and pinned them to their clothing. The rest of the crew already floated in the semi-cylindrical chamber, breathing hard and nursing bruises and a few sprains. Maya ordered them to count off and was relieved to hear the whole 100 run through without gaps. The room seemed very crowded. They hadn't gathered the whole 100 in one spot for many weeks, and even a max room didn't seem large enough. This one occupied a tank in the middle strand of the hub shaft. The four tanks surrounding theirs were filled with water, and their tank was divided lengthwise between their room and another semicylinder that had been filled with heavy metals. This semicylinder's flat side was their floor, and it was fitted inside the tank on circular tracks and rotated to counteract the spin of the ship, keeping the tub between the crew and the sun. So they floated in a non-rotating space, while the curved roof of the tank rotated over them at its usual 4 RPM. It was a peculiar sight, which along with the weightlessness made some people begin to look thoughtful in a pre-seasick kind of way. These unfortunates congregated down at the end of the shelter where the lavatories were located, and to help them out visually, everyone else oriented themselves to the floor. The radiation was therefore coming up through their feet, mostly gamma rays scattering out of the heavy metals. Maya felt an impulse to keep her knees together. People floated in place or put on Velcro slippers to walk over the floor. They talked in low voices, instinctively finding their next-door neighbors, their working partners, their friends. Conversations were subdued, as if a cocktail party had been told that the hors d'oeuvres had been tainted. John Boone rip-ripped his way to the computer terminals at the fore end of the room where Arkady and Alex were monitoring the ship. He punched in a command, and the exterior radiation data were suddenly displayed on the room's biggest screen. "Let's see how much is hitting the ship," he said brightly. Groans. "Must we?" exclaimed Ursula. "We might as well know," John said, "and I want to see how well this shelter works. The one on the Rust Eagle was about as strong as the bib you wear at the dentist's." Maya smiled. It was a reminder, rare from John, that he had been exposed to much more radiation than any of the rest of them. About 160 rem over the course of his life, as he explained now in response to someone's question. On Earth, one caught a fifth of a Rntgen equivalent man per year, and orbiting Earth, still inside the protection of the Earth's magnetosphere, one took around 35 per year. So John had taken a lot of heat, and somehow that gave him the right, now, to screen the exterior data if he wanted to. Those who were interested, about 60 people, clumped behind him to watch the screen. The rest relocated at the far end of the tank with the people worrying about motion sickness, a group that definitely didn't want to know how much radiation they were taking. Just the thought was enough to send some of them into the heads. Then the full force of the flare struck. The exterior radiation count shifted to well above the solar wind's usual level, and then soared in a sudden rush. An indrawn hiss came from several observers at once, and there were some shocked exclamations. "But look how much the shelter is stopping," John said, checking the decimeter pinned to his shirt. "I'm still at only 0.3 rem." That was several lifetimes of dentist's x-rays, to be sure, but the radiation outside the storm shelter was already 70 rem, well on its way to a lethal dose, so they were getting off lightly. Still, the amount flying through the rest of the ship, billions of particles were penetrating the ship and colliding with the atoms of water and metal they were huddled behind. Hundreds of millions were flying between these atoms and then through the atoms of their bodies, touching nothing, as if they were no more than ghosts. Still, thousands were striking atoms of flesh and bone. Most of those collisions were harmless. But in all those thousands, there were, in all probability, one or two, or three, in which a chromosome strand was taking a hit and kinking in the wrong way. And there it was. Tumor initiation, begun with just that typo in the book of the self. And years later, unless the victim's DNA luckily repaired itself, the tumor promotion that was a more or less unavoidable part of living would have its effect, and there would appear a bloom of something else inside. Cancer. Leukemia, most likely, and most likely, death. So it was hard not to regard the figures unhappily. 1.4658 rem, 1.7861, 1.9004. "Like an odometer," Boone said calmly as he looked at his decimeter. He was gripping a rail with both hands and pulling himself back and forth as if doing isometric exercises. Frank saw it and said, "John, what the hell are you doing?" "Dodging," John said. He smiled at Frank's frown. "You know, moving target." People laughed at him. With the extent of the danger precisely charted on screens and graphs, they were beginning to feel less helpless. This was illogical, but naming was the power that made every human a scientist of sorts. And these were scientists by profession, with many astronauts among them as well, trained to accept the possibility of such a storm. All those mental habits began channeling their thoughts, and the shock of the event receded a bit. They were coming to terms with it. Arkady went to a terminal and called up Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, picking it up in the third movement when the village dance is disrupted by storm. He turned up the volume, and they floated together in the long half-cylinder, listening to the intensity of Beethoven's fierce tempest, which suddenly seemed to enunciate perfectly the lashings of the silent wind pouring through them. It would sound just like that. Strings and woodwinds shrieking in wild gusts, out of control and yet beautifully melodic at the same time. A shiver ran down Maya's spine. She had never listened to the old war horse this closely before, and she looked with admiration and a bit of fear at Arkady, who was beaming ecstatically at the effects of his inspired disc jockeying and dancing like some red knot of fluff in the wind. When the symphony's storm peaked, it was difficult to believe that the radiation count wasn't rising, and when the musical storm abated, it seemed like theirs should be over too. Thunder muttered, the last gusts whistled through, the French horn sang its serene, all clear. People began to talk about other things, discussing the various business of the day that had been so rudely interrupted, or taking the opportunity to talk about other things. After a half hour or more, one of those conversations got louder. Maya didn't hear how it began, but suddenly Arkady said, very loudly and in English, "I don't think we should pay any attention to plans made for us back on Earth." Other conversations went silent, and people turned to look at him. He had popped up and was floating under the rotating roof of the chamber where he could survey them all and speak like some mad flying spirit. "I think we should make new plans," he said. "I think we should be making them now. Everything should be redesigned from the beginning, with our own thinking expressed. It should extend everywhere, even to the first shelters we build." "Why bother?" Maya asked, annoyed at his grandstanding. "They're good designs." It really was irritating. Arkady often took center stage, and people always looked at her as if she were somehow responsible for him, as if it were her job to keep him from pestering them. "Buildings are the template of society," Arkady said. "They're rooms," Saxe Russell pointed out. "But rooms imply the social organization inside them." Arkady looked around, pulling people into the discussion with his gaze. "The arrangement of a building shows what the designer thinks should go on inside. We saw that at the beginning of the voyage, when Russians and Americans were segregated into Taurus D and B. We were supposed to remain two entities, you see. It will be the same on Mars. Buildings express values. They have a sort of grammar, and the rooms are the sentences. I don't want people in Washington or Moscow saying how I should live my life. I've had enough of that." "What don't you like about the design of the first shelters?" John asked, looking interested. "They are rectangular," Arkady said. This got a laugh, but he persevered. "Rectangular, the conventional shape, with workspace separated from living quarters, as if work were not part of life. And the living quarters are taken up mostly by private rooms with hierarchies expressed, in that leaders are assigned larger spaces." "Isn't that just to facilitate their work?" Saxe said. "No, it isn't really necessary. It's a matter of prestige. A very conventional example of American business thinking, if I may say so." There was a groan, and Phyllis said, "Do we have to get political, Arkady?" At the very mention of the word, the cloud of listeners ruptured. Mary Dunkel and a couple of others pushed out and headed for the other end of the room. "Everything is political," Arkady said at their backs. "Nothing more so than this voyage of ours. We are beginning a new society. How could it help but be political?" "We are a scientific station," Sachs said. "It doesn't necessarily have much politics to it." "It certainly didn't last time I was there," John said, looking thoughtfully at Arkady. "It did," Arkady said, "but it was simpler. You were an all-American crew, there on a temporary mission, doing what your superiors told you to do. But now we are an international crew, establishing a permanent colony. It's completely different." Slowly, people were drifting through the air toward the conversation to hear better what was being said. Raya Jimenez said, "I'm not interested in politics." And Mary Dunkel agreed from the other end of the room. "That's one of the things I'm here to get away from." Several Russians replied at once. "That itself is a political position." "And the like," Alex exclaimed. "You Americans would like to end politics in history, so you can stay in a world you dominate." A couple of Americans tried to protest, but Alex overrode them. "It's true. The whole world has changed in the last 30 years, every country looking at its function, making enormous changes to solve problems, all but the United States. You have become the most reactionary country in the world." Sachs said, "The countries that changed had to because they were rigid before and almost broke. The United States already had flex in its system, and so it didn't have to change as drastically. I say the American way is superior because it's smoother, it's better engineering." This analogy gave Alex pause, and while he was thinking about it, John Boone, who had been watching Arkady with great interest, said, "Getting back to the shelters, how would you make them different?" Arkady said, "I'm not quite sure. We need to see the sites we build on, walk around in them, talk it over. It's a process I advocate, you see. But in general, I think workspace and living space should be mixed as much as is practical. Our work will be more than making wages. It will be our art, our whole life. We will give it to each other. We will not buy it. Also, there should be no signs of hierarchy. I don't even believe in the leader system we have now." He nodded politely at Maya. "We are all equally responsible now, and our buildings should show it. A circle is best. Difficult in construction terms, but it makes sense for heat conservation. A geodesic dome would be a good compromise. Easy to construct and indicating our equality. As for the inside, perhaps mostly open. Everyone should have their room, sure, but these should be small, set in the rim perhaps, and facing larger communal spaces." He picked up a mouse at one terminal, began to sketch on the screen. "There! This is architectural grammar that would say, all equal, yes?" "There's lots of prefab units already there," John said. "I'm not sure they could be adapted." "They could if we wanted to do it. But is it really necessary? I mean, it's clear we're already a team of equals." "Is it clear?" Arkady said sharply, looking around. "If Frank and Maya tell us to do something, are we free to ignore them? If Houston or Baikonur tell us to do something, are we free to ignore them?" "I think so," John replied mildly. This statement got him a sharp look from Frank. The conversation was breaking up into several arguments, as a lot of people had things to say, but Arkady cut through them all again. "We have been sent here by our governments, and all of our governments are flawed, most of them disastrously. It's why history is such a bloody mess. Now we are on our own, and I, for one, have no intention of repeating all of Earth's mistakes just because of conventional thinking. We are the first Martian colonists. We are scientists. It is our job to think things new, to make them new." The arguments broke out again, louder than ever. Maya turned away and cursed Arkady under her breath, dismayed at how angry people were getting. She saw that John Boone was grinning. He pushed off the floor toward Arkady, came to a stop by piling into him, and then shook Arkady's hand, which swung them both around in the air in an awkward kind of dance. This gesture of support immediately set people to thinking again. Maya could see it on their surprised faces. Along with John's fame, he had a reputation for being moderate and low-keyed, and if he approved of Arkady's ideas, then it was a different matter. "God damn it, Ark," John said. "First those crazy problem runs, and now this. You're a wild man, you really are. How in the hell did you get them to let you on board this ship, anyway?" "Exactly my question," thought Maya. "I lied," Arkady said. Everyone laughed, even Frank, looking surprised. "But of course I lied," Arkady shouted, a big upside-down grin splitting his red beard. "How else could I get here? I want to go to Mars to do what I want, and the selection committee wanted people to go and do what they were told. You know that." He pointed down at them and shouted, "You all lied! You know you did!" Frank was laughing harder than ever. Sax wore his usual Buster Keaton, but he raised a finger and said, "The revised Minnesota multiphasic personality inventory," and a great jeer went up from them all. They had all been required to take this exam. It was the world's most widely used psychological test and well regarded by experts. Respondents agreed or disagreed to 556 statements, and a profile was formed from the replies. But the judgments concerning what the answers meant were based on the earlier responses of a sample group of 2,600 white, married, middle-class Minnesota farmers of the 1930s. Despite all subsequent revisions, the pervading bias created by the nature of that first test group was still deeply ingrained in the test, or at least some of them thought so. "Minnesota!" Arkady shouted, rolling his eyes. "Farmers! Farmers from Minnesota! I tell you this now. I lied in answer to every single question. I answered exactly opposite to what I really felt. And this is what allowed me to score as normal." Wild cheers greeted this announcement. "Hell," John said, "I'm from Minnesota, and I had to lie." More cheers. Frank, Maya noted, was crimson with hilarity, incapable of speech, hands clutching his stomach, nodding, giggling, helpless to stop himself. She had never seen him laugh like that. Sax said, "The test made you lie." "What, not you?" Arkady demanded. "Didn't you lie too?" "Well, no," Sax said, blinking as if the concept had never occurred to him before. "I told the truth to every question." They laughed harder than ever. Sax looked startled at their response, but that only made him look funnier. Someone shouted, "What do you say, Michelle? How do you account for yourself?" Michelle Duval spread his hands. "You may be underestimating the sophistication of the RMMPI. There are questions which test how honest you are being." This statement brought down a rain of questions on his head, a methodological inquisition. What were his controls? How did the testers make their theories falsifiable? How did they repeat them? How did they eliminate alternative explanations of the data? How could they claim to be scientific in any sense of the word whatsoever? Clearly, a lot of them considered psychology a pseudo-science, and many had considerable resentment for the hoops they had been forced to jump through to get aboard. The years of competition had taken their toll, and the discovery of this shared feeling sparked a score of voluble conversations. The tension raised by Arkady's political talk disappeared. Perhaps, Maya thought, Arkady had diffused the one with the other. If so, it had been cleverly done. But Arkady was a clever man. She thought back. Actually, it had been John Boone who had changed the subject. He had in effect flown to the ceiling and come to Arkady's rescue, and Arkady had seized the chance. They were both clever men. And it seemed possible they were in some sort of collusion, forming a kind of alternative leadership, perhaps, one American, one Russian. Something would have to be done about that. She said to Michelle, "Do you think it's a bad sign we all consider ourselves such liars?" Michelle shrugged. "It's been healthy to talk about it. Now we realize we're more alike than we thought. No one has to feel they were unusually dishonest to get aboard." "And you?" Arkady asked. "Did you present yourself as a most rational and balanced psychologist, hiding the strange mind we have come to know and love?" A small smile from Michelle. "You're the expert in strange minds, Arkady." Then the few still watching the screens called out. The radiation count had started to fall. After a while, it slipped back to just a little above normal. Someone returned the pastoral to the moment of the horn call. The last movement of the symphony, glad and grateful feelings after the storm, poured from the speaker system, and as they left the shelter and fanned out through the ship like dandelion seeds on a breeze, the beautiful old folk melody was broadcast throughout the Ares, elaborating itself in all its Brucknerian richness. While it played, they found that the ship's hardened systems had survived intact. The thicker walls of the farm and the forest biome had afforded the plants some protection, and although there would be some die-offs and an entire crop they couldn't eat, the seed stocks weren't harmed. The animals couldn't be eaten either, but presumably would give birth to a healthy next generation. The only casualties were some uncaptured songbirds from Dee's dining hall. They found a scattering of them dead on the floor. As for the crew, the shelter's protection had shielded them from all but about 6 rem. That was bad for a mere 3 hours, but it could have been worse. The exterior of the ship had taken over 140 rem, a lethal dose. 6 months inside a hotel, with never a walk outside. Inside, it was late summer, and the days were long. Green dominated the walls and ceilings, and people went barefoot. Quiet conversations were nearly inaudible in the hum of machinery, the whoosh of ventilators. The ship seemed empty somehow, whole sections of it abandoned as the crew settled down to wait. Small knots of people sat in the halls in Taurus's B and D, talking. Some stopped their conversations when Maya wandered by, which she naturally found disturbing. She was having trouble falling asleep, trouble waking up. Work made her restless. All the engineers were only waiting, after all, and the simulations had gotten nearly intolerable. She had trouble gauging the passage of time. She stumbled more than she used to. She had gone to see Vlad, and he had recommended overhydration, more running, more swimming. Hiroko told her to spend more time on the farm. She gave it a try, spending hours weeding, harvesting, trimming, fertilizing, watering, talking, sitting on a bench, looking at leaves, spacing out. The farm rooms were max chambers, their barrel roofs lined with bright sunstrips. The multi-leveled floors were crowded with crops, many new since the storm. There was not enough space to feed the crew entirely on farm food, but Hiroko disliked that fact and struggled against it, converting storage rooms as they emptied out. Dwarf strains of wheat, rice, soy, and barley grew in stacked trays. Above the trays were hanging rows of hydroponic vegetables and enormous clear jars of green and yellow algae used to help regulate the gas exchange. Some days, Maya did nothing but watch the farm team work. Hiroko and her assistant, Iwao, were always tinkering at the endless project of maximizing the closure of their biological life support system, and they had a crew of other regulars working on it. Raul, Raya, Jean, Evgenia, Andrea, Roger, Ellen, Bob, and Tasha. Success in the closure attempt was measured in K values, K representing closure itself. Thus, for every substance they recycled, K equals I minus E over capital E, where capital E was the rate of consumption in the system, E the rate of incomplete closure, and I a constant for which Hiroko, earlier in her career, had established a corrected value. The goal, K equals I minus 1, was unreachable, but asymptotically approaching it was the farm biologist's favorite game. and more than that, critical to their eventual existence on Mars. So conversations about it could extend over days, spiraling off into complexities that no one really understood. In essence, the farm team was already at their real work, which Maya envied. She was so sick of simulations. Hiroko was an enigma to Maya. Aloof and serious, she always seemed absorbed in her work, and her team tended always to be around her, as if she was the queen of a realm that had nothing to do with the rest of the ship. Maya didn't like that, but there was nothing she could do about it. And something in Hiroko's attitude made it not so threatening. It was just a fact. The farm was a separate place, its crew a separate society. And it was possible that Maya could use them to counterbalance the influence of Arkady and John somehow, so she didn't worry about their separate realm. In fact, she joined them more than ever before. Sometimes she went with them up to the hub at the end of a work session to play a game they had invented called Tunnel Jump. There was a jump tube down the central shaft where all the joints between cylinders had been expanded to the same width as the cylinders themselves, making a single smooth tube. There were rails to facilitate quick movement back and forth along this tube, but in their game, jumpers stood on the storm shelter hatch and tried to leap up the tube to the bubble dome hatch, a full 500 meters away, without bumping into the walls or railings. Coriolis forces made this effectively impossible, and flying even halfway would usually win a game. But one day Hiroko came by on her way to check an experimental crop in the bubble dome, and after greeting them, she crouched on the shelter hatch and jumped, and slowly floated the full length of the tunnel, rotating as she flew, and stopping herself at the bubble dome hatch with a single, outstretched hand. The players stared up the tunnel in stunned silence. "Hey!" Raya called to Hiroko. "How did you do that?"
"Do what?"
They explained the game to her. She smiled, and Maya was suddenly certain she had already known the rules.
"So how did you do it?" Raya repeated.
"You jump straight," Hiroko explained, and disappeared into the bubble dome. That night at dinner, the story got around. Frank said to Hiroko,
"Maybe you just got lucky."
Hiroko smiled. "Maybe you and I should total 20 jumps and see who wins."
"Sounds good to me."
"What'll we bet?"
"Money, of course."
Hiroko shook her head. "Do you really think money matters anymore?" A few days later, Maya floated under the curve of the bubble dome with Frank and John, looking ahead at Mars, which was now a gibbous orb the size of a dime.
"A lot of arguments these days," John remarked casually. "I hear Alex and Mary got into an actual fight. Michelle says it's to be expected, but still..."
"Maybe we brought too many leaders," Maya said.
"Maybe you should have been the only one," Frank jibed.
"Too many chiefs?" said John. Frank shook his head.
"That's not it."
"No?"
"There are a lot of stars on board. The urge to excel and the urge to lead aren't the same. Sometimes I think they may be opposites."
"I leave the judgment to you, Captain," John grinned at Frank's scowl. He was, Maya thought, the only relaxed person left among them.
"The shrinks saw the problem," Frank went on. "It was obvious enough even for them. They used the Harvard solution."
"The Harvard solution," John repeated, savoring the phrase.
"Long ago, Harvard's administrators noticed that if they accepted only straight-A high school students and then gave out the whole range of grades to freshmen, a distressing number of them were getting unhappy at their D's and F's and messing up the yard by blowing their brains out on it."
"Couldn't have that," John said. Maya rolled her eyes. "You two must have gone to trade schools, huh?"
"The trick to avoiding this unpleasantness," they found, "was to accept a certain percentage of students who were used to getting mediocre grades, but had distinguished themselves in some other way."
"Like having the nerve to apply to Harvard with mediocre grades."
used to the bottom of the grade curve and happy just to be at Harvard at all.
How did you hear of this? Maya asked.
Frank smiled. I was one of them. We don't have any mediocrities on this ship, John said.
Frank looked dubious.
We do have a lot of smart scientists with no interest in running things. Many of them consider it boring. Administration, you know. They're glad to hand it over to people like us.
Beta males, John said, mocking Frank and his interest in sociobiology. Brilliant sheep. The way they mocked each other. You're wrong, Maya said to Frank.
Maybe so. Anyway, they're the body politic. They have at least the power to follow.
He said this as if the idea depressed him. John, due for a shift on the bridge, said goodbye and left. Frank floated over to Maya's side and she shifted nervously. They had never discussed their brief affair, and it hadn't come up, even indirectly, in quite a while. She had thought about what to say, if it ever did. She would say that she occasionally indulged herself with men she liked, that it had been something done on the spur of the moment. But he only pointed to the red dot in the sky. I wonder why we're going. Maya shrugged. Probably he meant not we, but I. Everyone has their reasons, she said. He glanced at her.
That's so true.
She ignored his tone of voice. Maybe it's our genes, she said. Maybe they felt things going wrong on Earth, felt an increased speed of mutation or something like that.
So they struck out for a clean start.
Yes.
The selfish gene theory. Intelligence only a tool to aid successful reproduction.
I suppose.
But this trip endangers successful reproduction, Frank said. It isn't safe out here.
But it isn't safe on Earth, either. Waste, radiation, other people.
Frank shook his head. No. I don't think the selfishness is in the genes. I think it's somewhere else.
He reached out with a forefinger and tapped her between the breasts, a solid tap on the sternum, causing him to drift back to the floor. Staring at her the whole while, he touched himself in the same place.
Good night, Maya.
A week or two later, Maya was in the farm harvesting cabbages, walking down an aisle between long stacked trays of them. She had the room to herself. The cabbages looked like rows of brains, pulsing with thought in the bright afternoon light. Then she saw a movement and looked to the side. Across the room, through an algae bottle, she saw a face. The glass of the bottle warped it. A man's face, brown-skinned. The man was looking to the side and didn't see her. It appeared he was talking to someone she couldn't see. He shifted, and the image of his face came clear, magnified in the middle of the bottle. She understood why she was watching so closely, why her stomach was clenched. She had never seen him before. He turned and looked her way. Through two curves of glass, their eyes met. He was a stranger, thin-faced and big-eyed. He disappeared in a brown blur. For a second, Maya hesitated, scared to pursue him. Then she forced herself to run the length of the room and up the two bends of the joint into the next cylinder. It was empty. She ran through three more cylinders before stopping. Then she stood there, looking at tomato vines, her breath rasping hard in her throat. She was sweating, yet felt chilled. A stranger. It was impossible. But she had seen him. She concentrated on the memory, tried to see the face again. Perhaps it had been... But no. It had been none of the hundred. She knew that. Facial recognition was one of the mind's strongest abilities. It was amazingly accurate. And he had run away at the sight of her. A stowaway. But that too was impossible. Where would he hide? How would he live? What would he have done in the radiation storm? Had she begun to hallucinate then? Had it come to that? She walked back to her room, sick to her stomach.
The hallways of Taurus D were somehow dark despite their bright illumination, and the back of her neck crawled. When the door appeared, she dove into the refuge of her room. But her room was just a bed and a side table, a chair and a closet, some shelves of stuff. She sat there for an hour, then two. But there was nothing there for her to do. No answers, no distractions, no escape.